This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, the podcast on TSN1290.ca.
We've arrived at number 12 to celebrate the greatness of Mark Scheifele, his captain, Blake Wheeler. After he went down in game one of the postseason, Wheeler himself recited the record. A few years ago when they went all the way to the conference final, he said Scheifele had 11 goals on the road. And I looked it up. No one's ever done that before. Not Gretzky, not anyone. That guy's special.
From NHL Network, Winnipeg Jets centerman Mark Scheifele being named the 12th best center in the NHL ahead of the 2021 season set to begin sometime. We're not sure when, but, you know, NHL and NHLPA, they'll get around to it one of these
days. 2021.
Early 2021. Yep. Yeah, you know, I guess that early gives you a nice broad range there, doesn't it?
January to February.
There you go. It's a nice broad range, like I said. Good morning, Winnipeg. Good morning, Manitoba. For all those joining us live this morning at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good morning, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Alongside Ezra Ginsberg, alongside Dave Minuk, I'm your host, Drew Mandel. We're thrilled to be with you for the next 3 hours. We got lots of Jets talk. We got lots of NHL talk. We got lots of talk about the return to play and divisional realignment and all sorts of fun, exciting things that are filling our days before the puck will eventually, maybe, hopefully, drop on what will be an abbreviated 2021 season.
We can agree that it's going to be 48 to 60 games, right? Like, there's nothing indicating that it's going to be more than 60.
I just don't think the calendar works for more than 60, and the longer this takes for them to hammer out an agreement, 60 becomes less and less of a possibility, but they probably have, like you said, most people say, 10 days to figure this out if they want to get started on, by the beginning of January. But this is the NHL and this is the NHLPA, so Lord knows they probably won't get it done in the next 10 days.
Well, I don't know about you guys, but I just hope that we spend at least 3 segments talking about escrow and salary deferral. Because, that's something that I think a lot of people want to talk about right now.
I think it's only one segment, so I'm afraid I'm going to have to disappoint you a little bit, but that's not till later on in the program. For now, we get started by talking about these top 12 or the top 20 centermen ranked according to the NHL Network. You heard the clip off the top of the show of the Winnipeg Jets ranking one player among the top 20. Last week, we talked about the wingers, and they had three wingers among the top 20. We said they could probably have a fourth, Nikolai Ehlers being omitted from that list. In this list, Mark Scheifele comes in at number 12 among the best centermen in the NHL. What do you think of that ranking? Is that, right where you have Scheifele? Is that too high? Is that too low? I know these rankings are all subjective, and admittedly that, you can take everything with a pretty sizable grain of salt, but what did you think about when you heard that Scheifele comes in at number 12?
Well, first of all, I hadn't heard of this until you put it in the show plan.
Okay, but, well, there you go. I'm doing the good research here.
David Satriano of NHL.com is providing us a lot of good content here, boys, because, aside from the reverse retro jerseys being revealed earlier this week from Adidas and Dave M putting out, the Jets prospects overseas report.
We'll get to that in the second hour.
Well, there's just not a lot of Jets news. So, I mean, Scheifele is exactly where I would put him. 12th seems right about right. And I think, guys, what's really important when you talk about this, you mentioned that it's subjective, Drew, but look who is right behind him. Like, you're talking about Sebastian Aho, John Tavares, Ryan O'Reilly, who just won the Conn Smythe Trophy a couple of years ago. Like, that's the company he's keeping here, right? And so you're talking about the best centers, like, just before him, Alexander Barkov, right? Like, Braden Point, Evgeny Malkin. Like, Evgeny Malkin's a future Hall of Famer, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is the company that Scheifele is keeping right now. And I think, beyond these rankings here, because, I think most people are going to have Scheifele top 20. Some might have him a little bit higher, guys, right? Like maybe 9, 10, 11, something like that. I don't think, many people are going to put him ahead of, Patrice Bergeron or Jack Eichel, who are 6 and 7, right? But I think what's going to be most interesting heading into the season, sure, he's coming off of that injury. We know he's 100%. I really don't think that's going to be an issue. But I think what's going to be most fascinating going into this year is who's going to be on the right wing of that top line. It's something that we've talked about on this show. It's something that's been talked about on a lot of the shows on TSN 1290. And there is a good shot that, Scheifele's going to have a different line mate this year, and we know who that's going to be. And there is always, the possibility that Paul Maurice goes back to Connor Scheifele Wheeler. But I think it's going to be interesting to see specifically how that impacts Shifley's game. Because we know that Shifley is one of the best offensive centermen in the league. That's undeniable. But it's also undeniable that at times Shifley's defensive game leaves you wanting more. And the advanced stats back that up, guys. There's no denying the fact that his defensive impact is not as great as his offensive impact. That's something, I think it was 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago, that we talked about on this show, that's something that you'd like to see, similar to Stevie Yzerman later in his career.
Yeah, that was the analogy we used when we talked about that.
Right, and Shifley's not later in his career. He's in his prime right now. 27 years old, he's in his prime. So we don't have to start talking about, you know, regression and everything like that. But I think it's really going to be interesting to see if Line A ends up being on that line, and you could even see Nikolai Ehlers, you know, on that line. You could see Shifley, Ehlers, and Line A. You know, it's going to be interesting to see how that impacts Shifley, because we know, and I think he would tell you this himself, that he wants to improve his defensive game.
You have to think, Dave, that as we've been sitting here in this extended offseason, and Mark Shifley, of course, you know, had the injury in game one of the play-in series against Calgary, and then obviously there was, you know, a rehab component to that, mm-hmm. you know, coming back from that injury. But you have to think that, you know, his offseason priority, to Ezzy's point, he's established himself as that upper echelon offensive centerman.
Yep.
That you know, and this is a guy who lives and breathes hockey, who is you know obsessed with the minutia of the game and improving himself. You'd have to think that the vast majority of this extended offseason would be about fine tuning and improving the defensive side of his game.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a fair point, Drew. I mean, I haven't been at the rink watching him skate, so I can't tell you that
right.
what he is.
I'm just
what
saying,
he,
you know, what exactly logically.
What exactly he is working on.
We
right.
want you to start going to that rink, Dave.
We don't know where the rink is or how you're going to get there.
Or what province it's
that's
in.
That's right. We're sending you to Ontario.
Yeah. But, no, I mean, I think that's a fair point. I think a lot of those guys, you know, who think offense, have to think defensively, especially in light of what happened to the Jets defense last year, right? With the losses that they suffered throughout the blue line, that was an area that the forward group needed to improve on, Mark Shifley being one of those players. So absolutely it's something that he needs to work on. I mean, is it something I couldn't tell you, because I have no idea again what his plan for the offseason was, but I would think logically, yes, Drew, it would make a lot of sense for him to say, I've already reached a point where my offensive game is elite, but now I need, because again, the whole point is, and I think, I don't remember if it was Craig Button, it was someone talking about, if you want to be mentioned in the same breath of the upper echelon guys in the NHL, you can't be a one-dimensional player.
Yeah.
You simply can't be the best offensive player. I mean, unless you're just elite like Connor McDavid, but then you still have to bring other aspects to your game, and that's one of those areas that Mark Shifley, I mean, again, if you're a student of the game, you're hearing these critiques, you know, so it's not like he's under the illusion that his game is 100% perfect, because again, if you pay attention, you pay attention. So you're hearing people say, well, you're not quite there because of X, Y, and Z. And X, Y, and Z generally would be his defensive game, obviously not his offensive game. So as a result, that would be the aspect, if you are a player who wants to be mentioned with Austin Matthews, Connor McDavid, Nathan MacKinnon.
And he is, in this article specifically, like he's mentioned in the sense of being a top 20 center, top 15 center,
Dave. Of course.
But I agree with you. When you talk about, like, you know, I mentioned Ryan O'Reilly, who I forget if
Ryan O'Reilly came in
14th or 15th.
He's 15th, right. and another guy who, of course, is always going to be compared to.
I know who you're going to say.
Yeah. Sean Couturier.
Right.
Couturier comes in at, I believe, number 18 on this list.
Right, and if you ask, if you did a random poll of coaches and executives and players, I wouldn't be surprised if guys like Ryan O'Reilly and Sean Couturier come in ahead of Shifley. If you ask them, which player do you want
as
your center
would.
In a playoff series, right? And that's no knock on Shifley, because...
Well, it's a knock on his defensive game.
Because it is.
Because that's where he's better than those players offensively. But on the defensive side, that's where he gives it all back.
Right, and who are we to criticize Shifley, you know, being the 12th-ranked center in the league? But, I mean, we're only being honest here, right? And Shifley is a type of player where you would call him an offensive-minded player. We know the work he's put in with Adam Oates and the work he has put in to become an elite centerman. But I think when you're talking about what it takes to have success in the playoffs, and again, you know, as I'm saying this, you go back to 2018, when the Jets almost made it to the Stanley Cup final, and it was unquestionable that Scheifele was one of the top centers. We remember what he did in that National Series. Yeah. I forget how many points he had. I want to say 18 or 19 points that year. He might have even had 20, I forget. But
well, that's the clip that we played off the top, talks about the number of road goals he had. He had the most road goals in the history of the Stanley Cup playoffs.
Absolutely, and the point is that he was an elite center who was leading his team to the Western Conference Final and almost the Stanley Cup Final, so we have to give him that. I mean, but I think he's going to benefit greatly from having Paul Stastny behind him, taking some away, you know, those maybe harder matchups, and also maybe not putting as much pressure on him to be the only center that's really producing a lot of offense. That's something that the Jets didn't have last year. That's one of the reasons why they acquired Stastny, because after Scheifele up the middle, you just didn't have a lot of production. Like, Cody Eakin came in and, you know, he scored a few goals and got a few points. But Cody Eakin is not a guy that you can expect to put up big offensive numbers in a second-line center role.
Well, he's
right?
not a second-line center.
Well, and that's why Buffalo signed him to be a third-line center, right?
Right.
Behind Stahl and Eichel. So, I mean, Scheifele has the ability there, but that's all we're saying here. Shifley's number 12 in the world. He could even be higher. But that's something that I think should be, you know, something to watch and see how his defensive game evolves. And I agree with Dave. We don't know what he's working on right now. It's certainly harder to work on the defensive side of your game as opposed to, you know, ripping wrist shots and working on your skating and working on the offensive side of the game. But I think to be in that same breadth, you know, as, you know, Patrice Bergeron and Sean Couturier and Ryan O'Reilly, Braden Point, some of those
the elite,
you know, elite
two-way center.
Exactly. And those are the guys that win the Stanley Cups.
That's right. And that's why, and Mark Scheifele knows that better than anybody else, that he knows that, you know, to get to that next level, he needs to be that all-around superstar.
I think your Steve Yzerman analogy is appropriate if you think about it, because when did the Wings start to really turn the corner and win cups?
Yeah. When Yzerman committed to the defensive side of the game.
And there was no doubting in the...
Sergei Fedorov helped too.
Having all those, having a lot of the Russian players help. Yeah. The Russian five definitely helped to drive the bus for the Red Wings, but, you know, and a few Swedes as well. But the fact of the matter is that really when you start to commit, I mean, again, you can be a top 10 scorer in the NHL, but what are the players who are helping to get their teams like to the Stanley Cup? And that's what any guy will tell you is important for them, right? Is to win a Stanley Cup. That's how you make memories. That's how you really get, you know, the guys who have phenomenal careers but don't win a cup, you know, they're always mentioned as, oh, they had an amazing career, but they didn't win that cup.
Yeah.
As opposed, I think you just see a player like Scheifele who has that kind of drive, you know, that's his, in the back of his mind, that's his driving force, is to win that Stanley Cup, to be mentioned as a center, a top center on a team, in an NHL team, who helped his team achieve that goal.
I think you make a good point when you talk about the impact of Paul Stastny. First of all, to take away some of the pressure and take away some of the defensive responsibilities. But, you know, Scheifele, I mean, it's sort of silly to think that he needs a mentor at this stage of his career. But to have a centerman, a veteran centerman like Paul Stastny, in which to learn from and to watch the intricacies of his game, particularly in his own zone, I think will be immeasurably helpful for a guy who we're assuming understands that that's where he needs to make an improvement. And this way he's got a sounding board in the dressing room with him where he can learn from Stasny's techniques, and Stastny can point some things out to him that may not otherwise be obvious to a guy who's just trying to refine that element of his game.
No, it's a good point, Drew. And, you know, the proof is there in 2018. And, you know, we're not saying that, you know, just because you acquire Paul Stastny from the Golden Knights, you're going to recreate that magic. But we've seen it. I mean, we've seen the results of what Stastny has done for the Jets up the middle. And I think, you know, if Laine does move up to the top line, and I think that's a strong possibility, guys. I realize that, you know, people have been calling for that for 3 years now.
Yeah.
But, you know, you have the friendship between Stastny and Wheeler, and not just the friendship, those guys can play well together, right? They've played, you know, a little bit internationally and so forth. So I think there's that you don't have to worry, you know, how is Blake Wheeler going to do on the second line with Stastny and Ehlers, right? Like, you don't have to worry about that. Those guys are veterans. They're pros. They're going to be fine. So it's that, and also, like we talked about before, that you have that veteran, great two-way forward, has accomplished so much in the league, and he's able to have that mentorship role for Scheifele. So you know, again, we're not being negative Nellies here and coming down on Scheifele, because as we mentioned at the top, you know, he's the 12th best center in the entire league. The company he keeps is absolutely elite, but we're just looking for a little bit more on the defensive side of his game.
Improvement will only help the Winnipeg Jets and will only, you know, get the Jets back to where they want to be, which is an upper echelon team, of course, in the Western Conference. When we come back, we're going to talk about Josh Morrissey and the areas of improvement needed for his game to resume to resemble back to a couple seasons ago. Before we go, our IC question of the day, and we want to hear from you on this. You can tweet us your responses at Illegal Curve, or you can text us your responses at 129090. Of the Jets forwards currently playing overseas, which one has the best chance of being a regular for the 2021 season? Just the forwards. We're talking Vesalainen. We're talking Gustafsson. Yuna Luoto, if you want to throw his name in there. There's a whole listing on illegalcurve.com. Dave does a great job of keeping sort of a spreadsheet or keeping track of what the Jets prospects are doing overseas. So we want to know from you, which Jets forward currently playing overseas has the best chance of being a regular on the team for the 2021 season? We'll talk about that. We'll talk about Josh Morrissey. We'll talk about much more. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturdays are for the Curve on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Battle in behind the net. Grabbed off by Scheifele. Plays it back for Tucker Pullman. Bouncing puck onto Laine. Down it goes. Scheifele on for Morrissey. Scores! Mark Scheifele with the feed to Morrissey, high glove, and Josh Morrissey, second of the year, has the Jets in front 1-0.
The dulcet tones of our good friend Dennis Bayak. Look forward to hearing him back on some calls eventually. Hopefully in the new year. Who knows? Time will tell when this NHL season gets underway. But for now, we have memories of Dennis and audio of Dennis calling Josh Morrissey's goal there against, I believe, the Florida Panthers. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturday morning, we're live here on TSN Radio 1290. Ezzy, should we be concerned that Dave just sprinted out of the room when the segment was about to start?
Yeah, I'm not sure what's going on there. Maybe it's a little bathroom break. Aside from that, I have no idea what just happened.
I'm not sure where Dave went. Anyways, yeah. He'll be back
it's
soon.
It's his
enough.
House. I guess he can go wherever
it's
he wants.
It's true. It
right?
is his house.
Yeah. We're confined to the couch.
That's right. He keeps us in a bubble.
You are.
Here.
I've got a chair.
That's true. Yeah, that's good. Enjoy that chair. Yeah. Anyways, welcome back. As I mentioned, this segment of the show brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center, official dentist of Illegal Curve Hockey. Don't be an Ezzy. Always wear a mouth guard and give yourself peace of mind protection, as well as facial teeth and mouth protection. To make an appointment to get your teeth tooting, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. There was an interesting article in The Athletic a couple weeks ago from Dom Luchishin, who covers the game for The Athletic strictly.
Yeah, Dom does a great job. Yeah.
Very analytical. He looks at the numbers. He does, you know, there's no eye test when it comes to Dom's analysis of the game. It's about the numbers and what the numbers are showing. And according to Dom's numbers and, you know, the rankings that he has used and the evaluation methods that he's used, he said that Josh Morrissey had the 10th worst contract in the NHL last season.
Yeah, that was very surprising to me.
That the value that Morrissey brought to the Winnipeg Jets, and then when you factor in the contract that the Jets pay him, that he had the 10th worst positivity value in the NHL.
You know what the funniest thing about this article is, Drew? You have Jacob Trouba on this list as well.
Right.
And you also have an honorable mention to Tyler Myers. So you basically have three of the six defensemen that led the Jets to the Western Conference Final. It's just kind of funny to me. Like, I realize that, you know, your cap hit is kind of attached to you.
That's what he's factoring in. He's factoring, okay, you're getting paid, you know, this amount of money.
No, I get that. I'm just saying, like, that was a pretty good, like, around the league, that was considered, like, the Jets were considered, you know, top five defense in the entire league back in 2018, right? With Ben Sherrod and
Justin Bufflin.
Did they have Toby Enstrom back then?
No.
Was Enstrom still there?
Enstrom was there because he sat the last game against Vegas.
They still had Enstrom on the third pair. So the point I'm trying to make is it's just funny. Like, it seems to always happen like that. Like, after you're coming off of, like, a good year, then you get paid, right? Like, Trouba gets the big deal. Myers gets the big deal. Morrissey's deal, I still think is pretty fair. Like, I still think he's a $6 million a year defenseman.
Well, that was my question. So at any point in time last year, and admittedly, and Josh Morrissey would probably say this as well, that he struggled at times during the year, which is no surprise given that...
Given there was nobody else there.
Yeah, given the transformation of the Winnipeg Jets defense last year. But to say that he had the 10th, the least productive contract or the 10th worst contract in the NHL strikes me as not being, fair. You really consider it, when you take the eye test into consideration.
Well, no, I don't know about that. I think he bases it on the numbers. So are the numbers lying to you? He's basically just saying, like, he uses his certain method of evaluating it, and based on his methodology, he came to this conclusion. So I you can't really fault him for it. And I think the irony to what Ezzie's point is that if Jacob Trouba is still on the Jets with Josh Morrissey, neither one of those contracts would be bad because of how good they play together.
Sure.
So, but I think it's just a function, guys. It's a function of what happens when you're left alone in a system. I think if Josh Morrissey had the insulation of all of those players that we mentioned, a few seconds ago, I think that it's a different situation. Now, I mean, look, but I think what it comes down to ultimately is when you look at the reality that was the Winnipeg Jets blue line last year, are you really pinpointing any of this on Josh Morrissey, and are you worried about his contract? Now, to me...
And that's the biggest problem I have with that article.
Yeah, I mean, I guess what my point, though, would be over the course of time with Josh Morrissey, you're not worried about it because, A, he's too good a player... Mm-hmm. And B,
he's 25 years old,
and not only
he's only going to get better.
And the Jets' defense will get better. And as a result,
he'll get better,
but so will the defense.
Look, the people around him. First off, having Dylan DeMello next to him for an entire season will only help.
We already know that the advanced stats have said not only at even strength, but on the penalty kill, the Jets were better after they acquired Dylan DeMello.
That's right.
And all due respect to Tucker Pullman, you guys know I'm a big Tucker Pullman guy.
He's a third pairing guy.
I mean, he right, and he can, he can step up and play a second pairing role, but when you ask Tucker Pullman and let's not forget, that was the first time in Tucker Pullman's career he'd ever played those types of minutes. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, he was a third pairing defenseman prior to that, an American Hockey League defenseman, and obviously he is an NHL defenseman now, but you look at where he was to end the year with Nathan Beaulieu on that third pair, right. and he was fine. He was mm-hmm. thriving, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not a knock on Pullman at all. Just Dylan DeMello is a better defenseman, and he fit in nicely with Morrissey. And the other thing I was going to mention about this list, it's amazing how many defensemen are on this list, mm-hmm. and one of them happens to be one of my favorite players who I still think is one of the best defensemen, even though the advanced stats don't necessarily bear it out, and that's Drew Doughty.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I'll take Drew Doughty on my team any day of the week, but you can't. This is the thing. This is the point I think Dave's trying to make here. The LA Kings were one of the worst teams in the league, right? The unmagnificent seven that didn't make the qualification round, right?
Like the seven teams that
The seven teams that didn't make the playoffs.
Did you just coin that yourself, or have you heard that from somewhere else?
I might have heard it. I might have made it up. I'm not sure, Drew. But the point I'm trying to make
where did that come from?
The Kings weren't good last year. So I think you have to factor that in. Look at who was Drew Doughty playing with last year, right?
Like, which is the same thing you can say
about
Morrissey.
His deep pairing. Yeah. I'm talking about his team. Like, the team wasn't good. So it's no surprise to see Drew Doughty up there, and he's getting a lot of money. Mark-Edward Vlasic, it is a terrible contract. I mentioned that last week. I mean, Mark-Edward Vlasic, his better days are behind him, I believe. Mm-hmm. He's still an NHL defenseman, but what's he making, $7 or $8 million a year? Yeah, Jeff Skinner, bad contract. Like, I have no problem with a lot of these players on Dom's list. Oliver Ekman-Larsson probably getting overpaid a little bit too much. Zaitsev, Trouba. Yeah, Trouba did not have a good year last year. Mm-hmm. But if you look at all those names, Josh Morrissey sticks out like a sore thumb. Like, well, to me, he doesn't fit on this list.
The teams that, the guys who I think you think are going to bounce back when their team around them improves are Doughty, to your point. Morrissey, certainly, because Morrissey still is younger than Doughty.
He wouldn't be on this list next year.
I'd be shocked if he's on this list.
Well, Drew Doughty's making $11 million a year. Mm-hmm. Like, it's almost like Doughty would have to put up 65 points really to prove that he's worth that.
But and remember, that's the whole point of his article, right? Is just simply to suggest that the money isn't justified based on, like, so it's not saying that the player is, it's not denigrating the player in the sense that the player isn't capable of playing at the NHL.
No.
It's, are they playing for the value that you're paying them? And again, that's not the player's fault that the GM gave them a bad contract. And again, if you're the LA Kings and you signed Drew Doughty to a deal, but you have Stanley Cups to look at, we've talked about this how many times on the show? If at the end of any of these Jets contracts, you're dealing with Blake Wheeler at $8.1 million, but you have a Stanley Cup to show for it.
You're not too concerned.
You're not overly concerned about how bad that contract looks in year five.
Right. No question. But the problem I have with what bothered me about this isn't that necessarily that Josh Morrissey's name is on it, But nowhere in the write-up does the writer acknowledge that a large part of this problem has to do with the fact that the Jets completely overhauled their defense. Mm-hmm. So to me, I think it's a little misleading.
Yes.
And that would be my criticism that I have, is like, if you want to say that Josh Morrissey struggled last year, I'll listen to that argument. But when you make that argument without acknowledging the fact that, you know, the defense was completely overhauled, that he was playing with players who were not suited to the role that they were playing with, I lose a little regard for the article at that point.
But it's like Dave said before, right? Like he's not providing context on purpose, right? Like he's only looking at the numbers.
You can't do that in hockey, especially when so much of your success, you know, depends on, you know, the forwards that you're playing with. It depends on your defensive partner. To just isolate one player player.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
But he did that.
I know. I think it's irresponsible.
The article is there, and that's what Dom does. And you know.
And that's why I think I lose a little bit of the, I think the article doesn't contain as much value for me as a reader or me as a hockey analyst to read someone else's opinion when it doesn't factor in the external factors.
I'm with you. And I think we all agree Josh Morrissey's a top 20 defenseman in the league, and he has a good shot at making Team Canada at the 2022 Olympics. Like, that's how good of a defenseman he is. Mm-hmm. Right? So to see that he's the 10th worst contract doesn't make sense with what I just said, right? Like, it doesn't mesh.
Right.
Like, if you're talking about a top 20 defenseman and a guy who's on the radar for Team Canada at the Olympics, and again, Dave mentioned this, this doesn't mean he's the 10th worst player. Mm-hmm. It's far from that. He's looking at how much a guy's getting paid versus, we talked about it, expected goals, right? Wins above replacement. Morrissey's offensive numbers took a hit. His defensive numbers took a hit. A lot of that has to do with what you just said, Drew, the revolving cast of characters, you know, the Carl Dahlstroms and the Lucas Abizas and all those guys that were basically put in as patchwork defensemen last year because you lost Trouba and you lost Myers and Sherratt and all
Bufflin,
these guys. So absolutely, Bufflin, you have to provide context. But
that's what, you know, I don't like about the article.
Looking at, first off, how is Milan Lucic not a 10 worst contract in the league? The guy scored 8 goals and he makes $6 million a year. Right? Like, 8 goals for 6 million. He gets $1 million for each goal.
Yeah. I respect hockey analytics. I respect that there's more than just a place for it, but that it's a significant factor. And, you know, to be a hockey analyst nowadays, you have to take that into account and you have to use it as part of your research. This is lacking a little bit right now in terms of being what I'll call fair analysis, this article, because it there's just factors in there that impact a player's success that have to be accounted for.
I guarantee you, Drew, if he comes out with his article next year, Josh Morrissey will not be on it.
I would be shocked if he would be on it again. When we come back, author Jeff Kerbison is going to join us. He's the author of a brand new book about the Winnipeg Jets in the 1980s. The book is called Broken Ribs and Popcorn. We'll talk to Jeff up next. Hold on, folks. It might be a little traumatic to anybody who remembers those days and were a Jets fan of 1.0. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturdays are for the Curve on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Saturday morning, welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live here on TSN Radio 1290. Drew Mindell, Dave Minuk, Ezra Ginsberg with you. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. That's where we're asking our Illegal Curve question of the day. Which current Winnipeg Jets forward playing overseas do you think has the best chance of making the Jets roster for the upcoming season? You can tweet us your responses at Illegal Curve. You can also text us your responses to 129090. And, of course, our website that has the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio, that's available at illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome to the program author Jeff Kerbison. He has a new book out called Broken Ribs and Popcorn, discussing the Winnipeg Jets 1.0 and their history or their legacy as one of the best teams in the NHL in the 1980s and early 90s to never win the Stanley Cup. Jeff, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning. Not one of the best teams to not win the Stanley Cup, the best team. To not win the Stanley
Cup. The best team. My apologies.
Yeah, come on, Drew.
Sorry, my apologies.
I had a couple guys.
I misspoke. We're off to a rocky start already, Jeff.
I had a couple guys from Philadelphia tweet at me and say, oh, the Flyers were the best team in the 80s to not win because they made the final twice. I said, yeah, they made the final twice, but they played in the East. They never played Edmonton and Calgary eight times a season, so they were quiet after that.
So you're not allowed to go to Philly anytime soon is basically what you're saying?
Yeah, that's fine. Who's going to Philly? Who's going anywhere in the States right now?
That's a very fair point. Nobody's going anywhere. So in Winnipeg, you're not public enemy number one. So
no.
you can wander the streets with impunity. Jeff, I guess the first question I have to ask is, you know, why now? Why is this the right time to write this book and publish this book? And you know, it's a terrific read, and we encourage everyone to pick it up. It's available at your local bookseller. You know, wherever you get books, that's available. That's where it's available. So why now? Why is this the right time to publish this book?
Well, this is it's sort of a sequel, I guess, to The Hotline, which came out 4 years ago, and the publisher at Great Plains Publishing at the time said, when you have a book that does okay, you need to follow it up. And I said, okay, and we mulled over a few ideas, and this was one idea that Greg Shilliday had, and he said, geez, these guys were so good, and but they just couldn't get by the Oilers. You should explore that. So and I did, and really, if you go back and talk to people and look at all the numbers, that 84-85 Jets team was so good. They were fourth overall in the league, and they had six players to score 30 goals. And they beat the Flames in the first round of the playoffs, losing Howardchuk, though, in the process with Jamie McCowan's cross-check. But they happened to play the 84-85 Oilers, who were voted the best team of all time. What do you do?
Yo, Jeff. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, that's good. No, you go.
Okay, I thought you were still going there. You know, you dropped off the book to my place on Thursday. First of all, I thank you for that. But I've only had a chance to read the first chapter, but I'm hooked already. And you know, you start off the book. You know, the title of the chapter is "The Night the Roof Came Off," referencing 1990 when Dave Ellett scores that goal in double overtime. The Jets go up 3-1. I was 8 years old at the time, and I remember, I can't remember, I have to ask my dad, I might have been in the building as an 8-year-old, but I definitely remember that at the time. And, you know, the Jets go up 3-1. We all know how the series ended, but just going back and listening, or reading, I should say, you know, that chapter, and, you know, Hustler, our good buddy, you know, is quoted in that, talking about how he was a young university student at that game with his buddies, you know, picking up tickets at 7-Eleven. First off, I just love, you know, getting that quote from Huss. But, you know, just going back to that series, Jeff, you know, up 3-1 on the Oilers, no Gretzky, you know, no coffee. We remember the flip-flopping between Bob Esenza and Stefan Beauregard. But just going back and you know, revisiting that and writing this book, writing that chapter, I mean, can it be overstated how disappointing that series was to lose that to the Oilers up 3-1?
No, because it was crushing. And the title of that chapter, "The Night the Roof Came Off," is in tribute to my former colleague and friend Randy Turner at the Free Press, who wrote a story on that that night, and that was the headline of his story. And of course, we lost Randy a couple of years ago. But that, if you look back in history, there had only been, I think, to that point, five instances where a team had come back from 3-1 and won, five or six. And one of them had been the year before, actually, when the Kings came back to beat the Oilers. But you thought, well, if you look at the odds, it's 90-something percent chance that we'll win this one. And it had been the whole decade had been full of disappointment against the Oilers. And at one point, the Oilers had beaten the Jets in the playoffs 16 times in a row, which is unheard of. And I put that to Glenn Sather, and he said, you'll never see that kind of dominance ever again. And it wasn't like we were getting blown out 10-1 in all these games. A lot of them were 3-2 and 4-3 games, a lot of overtime games. But the Jets couldn't solve the Oilers, and they would get up in games, and then the Oilers would have their vaunted attack would kick into gear, or they would just decide it's time. And so it was five series in a row where the Jets hadn't been held up by the Oilers, and yeah, it was crushing. It was especially because we were up in game five, and we had a 2-0 lead, and then Paul McDermott had a chance to, sorry, it was Brett Ashton who had a chance. to put us up three, put the Jets up three, and slipped a puck between Bill Ranford's legs on a breakaway, and Ranford did one of those crazy reach backs and pulled it off the goal line. And even Ranford said to me, if the Jets go up three there, I think it's over. And so, yeah, we had our chance. We were a couple inches away, and you can just imagine if you remember in the 80s that we all hated Edmonton so much because Gretzky would get 6 points against us all the time. And sure, you cheered for Gretzky and Messier when they wore the Team Canada colors, but you wanted nothing more than to beat these guys. And because they were arrogant, and they admit that they were arrogant, and you just wanted to finally knock them off, and to not do it was still something that I think that the city hasn't recovered from. And we need to play Edmonton in the playoffs one year and beat them to finally, I think, slay that dragon.
You know, Jeff, if you're a certain vintage, the 87 Canada Cup's probably the greatest international tournament that you witnessed. And, you know, that final face-off with, you know, you had the Gretzky, Howardchuk, and Lemieux with the ability to take it, and they let it, Dale Howardchuk take it. And, you know, I have to tell you, from reading, you know, the story you put forth, I learned a lot about Howardchuk, is his involvement in that 87 Canada Cup. But how did you go about learning that? What can you tell our readers about, our listeners, sorry, about that process? Because really, you know, from folks here in Winnipeg, you always saw Dale Howardchuk. He was a top center. He was an unbelievable hockey player. But with all that talent, there wasn't even a guarantee he'd make that team.
Well, sure. I chatted with Tom Watt, who was Howardchuk's first coach here in Winnipeg, and Watt was an assistant coach on that team. And he said in no uncertain terms that they didn't have Howardchuk penciled in to make that team because they had a lot of great players down the middle. Already down the middle, you've got Gretzky, Lemieux, Messier. So where's Howardchuk going to play? There's also trying out for the team with Steve Yzerman. There's Doug Gilmour. There's Howardchuk. So they didn't think he was going to make it. And so they, early on in the tryouts, they figured, well, we'll try these guys on the wing. Someone's got to play on the wing. And Howardchuk adapted, and he was one of the guys who was able to make it on the wing. So did Gilmour. Steve Yzerman, one of the greatest players of all time, didn't make it. He got cut, and everyone remembers the shock when a guy who had scored 65 goals one season gets cut from a team like that. But Howardchuk was adaptable, and he was able to check his ego at the door. He told me that he knew that he wasn't going to get any power play time, and that was fine, and that he wasn't going to see a lot of ice time. He wasn't going to be able to hop over the boards with the same regularity that he was used to in Winnipeg because of all these great players ahead of him. But he told me that he and Gilmour would sit on the bench, and they would say, okay, if we're only going to get 5 or 6 shifts this game, we're going to make them the best 5 or 6 shifts they're ever going to see. And so as the series went on, Gilmour and Howardchuk earned the respect of the coaches and the trust, and they got more and more ice time. And they as the tournament wore on, they played a bigger and bigger role. And in that last minute and a half of game three, there, I mean, Howardchuk admits that he probably wouldn't have gone on for that if Messier hadn't just come off from a shift and he was tired. So he got sent out with Gretzky and Messier. And, of course, Gretzky and Messier made the team at center, so you would expect one of those guys to take the faceoff and not a guy who made the team as a winger. And Gretzky said, I'm not taking it. And Lemieux said, well, it's not my side. I'm not taking it. And Howardchuk thought, well, he's not going to turn back and look at Larry Murphy or Paul Coffey, so he's taking it. And he just told
Jeff Kerbis. Sorry, go ahead, Jeff.
No, he just told Mario, okay, I'm going to tie him up. And then he had to tie up Bykov, who was one of the leading scorers on the Soviets, and of course he did. And then the Jets had that breakout. And when you watch the replay from the Canadian end, as you see Gretzky going up and looking at Murphy the whole time, and then passing back to Lemieux, and you see Bykov is the one guy who has a chance to get back at Lemieux. And Howardchuk reached out, gives him a little tug on his left hip. And he went down theatrically. Howardchuk described it to me as a goofy dive. And that, of course, so Lemieux was unimpeded. And I tweeted this story out. I had an excerpt in the National Post a couple weeks ago. And I tagged Paul Stewart, who was the referee, in it, and he said there was no way he was going to call a penalty on that play because his mantra was, let him play, especially on a play that was such an obvious dive. So anybody who still thinks that Canada got away with something there, the referee said not a chance. And back then, too, you could impede a player and break his stride, and that wasn't a penalty. So it was a different time.
Jeff Kerbison is our guest on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290. His book is called Broken Ribs and Popcorn, discussing the Winnipeg Jets 1.0 of the 80s and 90s. Jeff, let's talk about the broken ribs. If McCowan doesn't break Howard Chuck's ribs, how does that change the legacy, I guess, of that Winnipeg Jets team in the 80s?
Well, in talking with some of the Oilers players, they were obviously confident against no matter who they were going up against, but losing Howard Chuck and taking your captain out of the lineup, taking the quarterback, your power play out of the lineup, they obviously knew that the task wasn't going to be as difficult. And even though the Jets had such depth with five other 30-goal scorers, I think the mountain was just too high. And geez, it would have been fun to watch that series, right? To have our best team ever against their best team ever. And, yeah, maybe we wouldn't have won it, but it would have been fun to have Howard Chuck in the lineup. The Jets didn't have Grant Fuhr or a Grant Fuhr-type goaltender. They had Brian Hayward at the time. But it would have been fun to watch. And it's just too bad that Howard Chuck couldn't play. And he was trying. They were trying out various flak jackets on him in practice, but he had two or three broken ribs, and that's you can't hide that. And so if he'd gone out there, there's no question. You don't think that Glenn Anderson, if given a chance to give Howard Chuck a butt end in the ribs, he would have done that in a second. So even if he had gone out there, he wouldn't have been as effective, and then somebody would have done something to take him out. And so it's just unfortunate that when he came in on McCowan, in the Flame series, the Flames had been hemmed in their zone and couldn't get out. And so McCowan, when they finally got the puck out quickly, they didn't have the Jets got it back right away, and they didn't have a chance to make the change. And so McCowan was caught flat-footed, and he saw Howitzer coming in full bore. He thought, well, I can start skating backwards, and he's going to go around me in half a second. Or I can reach out and give him a cross check, like it happened 200 times previously in that game, in both ends of the ice. And there had been, not only had there not been any injuries, there hadn't been any penalties on plays like that. And Howard Chuck had a habit of jumping around players when he's making his moves, and he just happened to lift his arm at the wrong time. And instead of getting the cross check across his forearm or his bicep where he's got padding, he got it on his ribs where there's nothing, and he went down. And you know, when Howard Chuck goes down, he doesn't go down to try and fish for penalties. He was hurt, and it's probably the most unfortunate play in Jets 1.0 NHL history.
Jeff, last question for you here. I mentioned earlier I've only had an opportunity to read the first chapter of the book, but I've actually
skipped ahead. It's all downhill
from there. I think it was absolutely not. I skipped ahead actually, and I read chapter 5, Tuxedo Night, and what I found most interesting is I of course had heard of Tuxedo Night, even though it happened a few years before I was born. But what I didn't know about Tuxedo Night is that the Jets won that game, and that game featured the first ever Jets hat trick in NHL history. That of course was Willie Lindstrom. The Jets won that game 6-2. And when you look back, on that game, considering that was the first time the Jets had ever been on Hockey Night in Canada, and it's funny, in the chapter you mentioned that Malabar was a sponsor of that night, and it was really a big deal for Winnipeg because it was always Toronto, Montreal.
Sure.
It was never Winnipeg on Hockey Night in Canada. And when you think back on that night, and of course for those who don't know, Jeff, and you can go into it in more detail as you do in the book, Bobby Hull didn't end up playing that game because he wasn't, he forgot that the game time had changed. So Tom McVie, of course, famously didn't play him. But do you think it gets lost sometimes about that tuxedo night, looking back, the fact that the Jets won that game against an absolutely stacked Habs team?
I don't think it gets lost. I think people remember that because the Jets, for whatever reason, did really well on tuxedo night. They beat the Canadiens the next year on tuxedo night also. And that was the defending Stanley Cup champions. But obviously, if they had played 99, if they played 100 times, the Canadiens would have won 99 times. That was the one time, I think, where the other Jets players will say that every pass they made, every deflection off a skate or off a stick happened to go to the right place. And they also caught a team that was on the road and might not have been getting up too much for the Jets, who they knew were one of the weaker teams in the league. But I think what's too bad about it is that what happened with Hull, in that obviously if Bobby Hull doesn't come to Winnipeg in 1972, there's no NHL Jets in 79. There's no NHL Jets in 2011. And he didn't get the memo or whatever it was about the time change for Hockey Night in Canada. And what Hockey Night in Canada wants, Hockey Night in Canada gets. So he's at home sitting around getting ready to come to the game when Lars-Eric Schoper calls him and says, Bobby, you got to get over here. So he only lived in Tuxedo. He drove over there right away and got there. But the team was getting ready to go out there for warm-up, and he wasn't there. And Tom McVie, who might be the funniest guy in hockey, but he's also a taskmaster, and he had rules. And his rule was he needed to be there a certain amount of time before the game. I think it's 90 minutes or 60 minutes. I think it's 90 minutes. And he shows favoritism to Bobby Hull. Is that going to will the younger players not adhere to the rules as much because they see that there are favorites being played? So he stuck to his guns, and he has a very comical story about John Ferguson coming down and saying, "Well, where's Hull?" And he said, "Well, I sent him home." And he's, "Shut up. Where is he?" "No, I sent him home. He was late." And Ferguson keeps going back to his office and coming back to McVie's office, and he gets madder and madder. And finally, at the end, he kicks McVie's door and doesn't realize it's one of those hollow doors. So his foot goes right through it, and he can't get his foot out of the door. So he's hobbling around. He's furious, and McVie is watching this, and they're old friends, and he is trying his best not to laugh his head off in this very serious situation. And finally, Fergie gets his foot out of the door, and he turns to McVie and says, he keeps saying to him, "Do you realize this is Hockey Night in Canada, coast to coast, Hull's first time against Montreal since 1971 or 72? And McVie said, "Yeah, I realize that. And the last thing he said was, "Do you realize that Bobby Hull is one of the owners of this team?" And McVie said, "Oh, I didn't know that."
Jeff Kerbison is the author of Broken Ribs and Popcorn. It's available at booksellers everywhere. Jeff, it's a great read. Thank you for coming on air to share the story with us. Congratulations on another masterpiece regarding the Winnipeg Jets 1.0.
Always appreciate the opportunity. Thanks, guys.
Take care, Jeff. Thanks so much. When we come back, we discuss Andrew Kopp and his future here in Winnipeg. Much more to come. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Saturdays are for the Curve on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Pionk up on the right side. Jets carry in long. Rick Schottner lost with a turtle. Andrew Kopp is on scores! Andrew Kopp jams it across the goal line.
Andrew Kopp scoring against the St. Louis Blues earlier this year. Welcome back to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A couple minutes before 10 o'clock, this segment of the program brought to you by our good friends Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of our clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com. So we played Andrew Kopp there, and I think he's sort of one of the most fascinating Jets players right now in the sense that...
He's on the return to play committee?
Well, I mean, he is on the return to play committee. That wasn't what I find fascinating about him. I'm talking about his future here in Winnipeg. He's obviously under contract for this year. Mm-hmm. at the end of the season, he's an RFA, and he's 1 year away from UFA status. So I think the Jets, and certainly Andrew Kopp, have a decision to make regarding his long-term future here. Mm-hmm. Is this a guy that the Jets want? I mean, he's eligible for a contract extension now if the Jets wanted to sign him to a longer-term deal and keep him here and buy out a couple of UFA seasons. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think to me, both sides have this have a decision that they have to make. Does Andrew Kopp want to make continue to make a commitment to the Winnipeg Jets organization by signing here for another, you know, 2 years or 3 years, whatever it might be? Do the Jets want to commit to Kopp for longer than through this year and probably next, where he's, of course, an RFA? And, you know, how much do you think his usage this coming season will factor into the decision-making that will go into his decision, Dave?
Well, I mean, I think those are all factors, and I think also you have to look at the pipeline, right? What is the Jets' pipeline for the future? Are you going to have players that could be, you know, mm-hmm. in the pipe that who can replace them? You know, I featured David Gustafsson's shootout winner last night. It was his sixth goal in the Swedish league. So, I mean, will David Gustafsson be a guy who can take the next step and step in if you don't have Andrew Kopp, you know, after next year? So they're all factors. I think Andrew Kopp fits well in this team. I think he's been that Swiss Army knife player that the Jets have liked to have. I think mm-hmm. you could, again, get him for a reasonable term. I mean, his numbers, he's not going to come in at a huge number. We do know that, I don't remember the percentage, but when players go to salary arbitration, they're generally not with the team
right.
thereafter.
Once you go to arbitration and once the arbitrator makes the decision, more often than not, it spells the end of that player's time
right.
in the city.
Now with Andrew Kopp, it seems, again, like I said, that he's, you know, very connected to a lot of the players on this team, and he's connected to the city. He, you know, wants a bigger role. I mean, he may not like the fact that, you know, we know he spoke about it. And again, this isn't a negative. He wanted that second line center position. I mean, mm-hmm. and that's a good thing. You want players to want to achieve success, right? You don't want a guy who's satisfied with a role that he doesn't feel is sufficient for him. However, the problem is, clearly the Jets didn't feel that he was that player because they went out and got Paul Stastny.
Yeah.
So the reality is, could he fit in that top six for you? Maybe, but likely more in that third line role. And again, from my perspective, is that going to be sufficient for Andrew Kopp?
And I think, you know, we've talked about this before, Dave, like, the Seattle expansion draft is going to play a factor in
right.
this as well.
Sure.
Because we know, you know, the top six, we don't have to go over, everybody knows yeah. the Jets' top six. Those guys are all going to be protected,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you're going to go with, what is it, 7-3-1?
7-3-1.
So, I mean, we've talked about Jansen Harkins could be a guy that the Jets want to protect.
Yeah.
I've made that argument
uh-huh.
for Jansen Harkins, right? And then you're talking about the other guys that are in that conversation, Andrew Kopp and Adam Lowry.
Yeah.
Right? And I think Drew brings up an interesting question there because, you know, Kopp is not a guy that's going to cost $5 million a year.
Right.
Right? Like, he's probably going to be in the $3 million range, maybe closer to $4 million. Like, I haven't looked at the comparables, but I think that, you know, Kopp would, most of you guys would agree that, you know, that's going to be right around where he's going to get, what he's going to get, I should say. But you've got Patrick Laine, mm-hmm. who's got his next contract coming up. Neil Pionk as well has got 1 year left on his deal. So the Jets are going to have other players to sign.
Mm-hmm.
And as I mentioned before, with the guy like Jansen Harkins, who's 3 years younger, and I believe Harkins got a 2 year deal. So he's going to be making less than $1 million.
Yeah.
The year that Andrew Kopp becomes, you know, an RFA. And I think Drew makes a really good point because it's right around 27 years old, right, when you start to get that big contract. And Kopp is not a guy that you're going to sign to a 1 year deal.
No.
At 26 years old. Kopp is a guy that's probably looking, I imagine he's looking for a 4 year deal.
I think or even a five year deal, right?
And I think he's earned it. So, I mean, I can't predict the future, obviously, but, you know, if you're asking me, Drew, I think the Jets should absolutely re-sign Kopp. I think he's been a great foot soldier. And, you know, Dave mentioned Swiss Army knife. He's a guy that's played for the majority of his time on the wing, but he's a guy that can also play center. Those players are very versatile. Even though he's been a third-line guy for the Jets, he absolutely has the ability to go to the second line or even the first line, even though you have more skilled players there. So, you know, it'll be something interesting to watch, but I do think the expansion draft – is going to be interesting to see if they go with Kopp or maybe a younger guy like Harkins.
When we come back, one of the most perplexing teams this offseason has been the Chicago Blackhawks. Charlie Remouliotis of NBC Sports Chicago is going to join us to talk about the Blackhawks offseason. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of the Illegal Curve Hockey Show starts now on TSN Radio 1290 alongside Ezra Ginsberg, alongside Dave Manuke. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. You can reach us via Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can also reach us via text message. Send your text to 129090. Standard messaging rates do apply. And our website with the latest Winnipeg Jets news and audio is available at illegalcurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From NBC Sports in Chicago, we're pleased to welcome to the program Charlie Remouliotis. Charlie, good morning, and thanks so much for joining us. How are you?
Good morning, guys. Thanks for having me.
Our pleasure, Charlie. Obviously brought you on to talk about the Blackhawks. And, you know, we've been over the last number of weeks sort of talking about the off seasons for a number of the teams in the NHL. And I think for a lot of us, one of the most perplexing off seasons belonged to the Blackhawks themselves. We know that, you know, Stan Bowman, general manager, came out and wrote that letter to fans basically saying, we're rebuilding. But at the same time, it's an odd time to be rebuilding when you still have big ticket contracts on your books like Kane and Taves, and of course, you know, Duncan Keith to a bit of a lesser extent than the ten million plus that Kane and Taves are making. So, you know, if you're Jonathan Taves and you're Patrick Kane and you're Duncan Keith and you are used to winning or at least competing to win, how do you feel about that letter that Stan Bowman released?
Yeah, it's definitely, you know, as a player, you obviously, you don't care about the future, right? Like, you want to win right now, especially if your competitors like Kane and Taves and Keith, who have experienced so much success over the last decade with the Blackhawks. But I do think when that letter got sent out, there was a little bit of confusion or maybe a miscommunication, because it felt like the letter to the fan base was the team saying we're going through a full rebuild. And we you know, Stan Bowman did his media rounds after that letter came about, and he basically clarified, like, this isn't going to be a full-on rebuild. This is more, we want to be more transparent with the fans in our direction. And it's a direction we've already been going on for the last 12 to 18 months, how they are, you know, having this youth movement with Kirby Dach and Adam Boqvist, and Ian Mitchell is going to be part of the fold this year. So I don't think it's a change in direction of more of, we're just being more open about the direction, because I remember the New York Rangers obviously sent out a similar letter, but the difference between the two letters was the Rangers sent that letter before they were about to rebuild, whereas the Blackhawks kind of had to send out this letter to clarify to their fan base, like, hey, you know, Kane, Taves, Keith, like, these guys are still going to be here, and we're just kind of retooling on the fly here to give those guys some extra help when it comes to the playoffs and giving them more depth.
Well, Charlie, I wanted to ask you about, you know, the big move that was made that kind of caught a lot of people by surprise. I imagine there were some Blackhawks fans that were probably caught by surprise a little bit more, but that, of course, is Brandon Saad being moved to the Colorado Avalanche for Nikita Zadorov. And, you know, I think a lot of people, once that trade happened, and obviously Corey Crawford signing with the Devils, you know, people were looking at those moves and saying, you know, I guess this means the Blackhawks are going to be rebuilding now. But, you know, that move's interesting to me, because I think you'd look at it, if you look at it from, you know, the one-for-one perspective, you'd say, okay, well, Brandon Saad's a really good winger. I mean, this is a guy that, you know, Colorado won the trade here, but Nikita Zadorov was a guy that I think you'd agree his game was starting to really round out in Colorado. He's maybe better suited to be a second pairing defenseman on the Blackhawks as opposed to a first pairing defenseman. But how would you break down that trade? Because it seems like, you know, the Blackhawks and Stan Bowman are really high on Zadorov, and they really think that he can, you know, solidify that back end.
Yeah, it was really the day after that trade that Jonathan Taves, you know, was very vocal about the moves and the direction, and saying, you know, that the core has been blindsided by this direction. And because at the time it was, you know, Stan Bowman had announced that the Blackhawks weren't going to re-sign Corey Crawford, and then they make that trade. And so you're like, okay, wait a second here. Subtracting Corey Crawford, getting rid of Brandon Saad, and bringing in Nikita Zadorov, where are the additions? And the additions didn't come until after that, right? Like they signed Matthias Janmark, they signed Lucas Walmark, and so they didn't make those additions. So that's why it was confusing to the core. And so I think the Blackhawks like what Zadorov brings. He's a guy that we had Jeremy Colleton on our podcast a couple weeks ago, and he said we want to pair him with one of our young right-handed shot defensemen where he can protect them. And Adam Boqvist or Ian Mitchell, those guys will play on the right side, and Zadorov will play on the left side. And he's obviously a big physical defenseman, and so they like what he brings to the table. But maybe perhaps more importantly, it opened up a little bit of cap space for the Blackhawks. And when we talked to Stan Bowman, he said having that cap flexibility down the road is going to be crucial for this team if they want to get back to being, a perennial contender, because they felt like they weren't going to re-sign Brandon Saad after this season. And so they were like, let's just get a player out of him. And it also opened up room to allow them to re-sign Matthias Janmark. So it was kind of like a twofold trade, right? They trade Brandon Saad, get Nikita Zadorov, and then they also go out and use that extra money to get Janmark. So I think it was kind of a two-part trade, and that's how they internally viewed it.
You know, Charlie, based being a Winnipeg-based show, we're generally focused on what's going on with the Jets, and right now it's the talk is of an all-Canadian division, and which means the Central Division, which I looked at some of the proposed, is going to be a little different than what we're used to seeing. But it's almost like a rebirth of the Norris Division rivalry between the Red Wings and the Blackhawks. Not quite what it was from 1981 to 1993, but is that one of the moves that's kind of, I guess, a little bit of exciting for folks in Chicago to see that? Again, those teams aren't what they were, but to have that kind of the Red Wings back in the division, kind of renew that rivalry that they had for so many years?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's kind of funny that you say that because, you look at that division alignment and it's like Chicago and Detroit might be the two worst teams in that division. And so it was unfortunate too because Detroit moved out of that division when Chicago was kind of really in the heart of their dynasty run. And so I'm sure if you ask the Blackhawks, like, wait a second, they beat up on us for all these years. It would be nice to kind of return the favor. But then they head out east. So, yeah, it's going to be a fun rivalry. I think if you're Chicago or Detroit, you're probably looking at that division like, holy cow, like, we got Tampa in here. We got Florida, Pittsburgh. Like, I think seven Stanley Cups in the last 10 years are in that division. So that's going to be a brutal juggernaut for the Central if that division does come true. But, yeah, I think that's kind of like an added bonus, especially if the seven teams in that division are going to be playing each other for however many seasons. Like, it's a 60-game season. Chicago and Detroit's playing each other 10 times. And so I'm sure that'll be fun inside the city and also Detroit as well.
Well, familiarity breeds contempt, as the old saying goes. So, rivalries will certainly be created with a heavy division schedule of that nature. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Charlie Remouliotis of NBC Sports Chicago is our guest. Charlie, you look at the Blackhawks goaltenders, and under contract at the, NHL level, you have Colin Delia and you have Malcolm Subban. What hope is there for Blackhawks fans that, and with no due disrespect to those guys, that isn't the worst goaltending tandem in the NHL this coming season?
Yeah, it's a really tall order for those guys. And when they went to the bubble in Edmonton, Corey Crawford had more postseason appearances than the other four goaltenders that the Blackhawks carried had regular season games total. So this is a wildly inexperienced goaltending tandem, or I should say trio, if you throw in Kevin Lincoln in there as well. And so I think they're really just hoping that they have more clarity on what Subban and Delia are as a tandem. Colin Delia was supposed to be the backup goaltender last year, but Robin Leonard suddenly became available, and the Blackhawks looked at that as an opportunity to have this dynamic 1-2 tandem. And so Delia, he struggled a little bit in Rockford at the beginning of last season, but then really turned it around in the second half. And so they probably view him as a guy that he's been in the organization for 3 years now, and he's proven himself at the AHL level. And they're like, let's see maybe if he can run with it at the NHL level. And then you also have a guy in Malcolm Subban, who obviously is a former first-round pick, so the potential is there. And he's never really gotten that opportunity to be a full-time starter or compete for, the full-time starter role because he's been behind Marc-Andre Fleury in Vegas. So I think they're really – I don't think they're banking on one of the three to pan out. I think they just want to see what they have in the three so they know how to make that decision with their goaltenders after next season, because it's just going to be such a strange year in the NHL.
You know, you mentioned Robin Lehner, and you know, when they signed Lehner, the Blackhawks, when they signed him to that 1 year contract last offseason, I thought it was a great value. You know, 1 year, there's no such thing, our expression, there's no such thing as a bad 1 year contract, and this could be a guy who could be sort of that natural bridge from Corey Crawford to Lehner, and then maybe even get, you know, some of these other younger players some time and more seasoning. You know, do you think the Blackhawks erred in not signing Lehner to a longer term deal and then eventually trading him to the Golden Knights and not getting, you know, with all due respect to Malcolm Subban, not getting much of a return for him?
Yeah, it's strange, because I'm sure if you would have told them last year that, hey, there's going to be a pandemic and you guys are going to sneak into the playoffs as the 24th team, and I'm sure they would have loved to have the Corey Crawford and Robin Lehner tandem. But at the same time, I wonder how that would have complicated their financial situation if they did commit to Robin Lehner long term. But I still, you know, it's just so bizarre how last season started with Corey Crawford and Robin Lehner, and you figure, okay, one of those two is coming back. And I don't know how we got to a point where neither of them are in Chicago this year. So it's certainly strange that, you know, they dealt Robin. I think it was the right call at the time to trade Robin Lehner. If you weren't going to sign him to a longer-term deal, like, you had to recoup assets for him at the trade deadline. But, yeah, it's difficult to kind of connect the dots or to kind of look at the full picture and be like, man, how are Crawford and Lehner, or neither of them are in Chicago to start the season? It's a little strange.
Charlie, last question for you here. We have an RFA that's currently still not signed in Jack Roslovic. I think you'd agree that across the league it's gone pretty quiet, and you have a lot of RFAs that haven't signed. You look at Tampa Bay, you've got Anthony Cirelli and Mikhail Sergachev, and I think you know where I'm going with this. Dylan Strome still unsigned. Is there any update there? Do you expect him to sign anytime soon, or is it like everything else these days in the hockey world, we're just, you know, playing that waiting game?
Yeah, it's really the last domino to fall for the Blackhawks, and it sounds like Stan Bowman is optimistic that that is going to get done. Dylan Strome obviously doesn't have arbitration rights, so he doesn't really have much leverage, and the Blackhawks can really just extend him a qualifying offer, and he can sign that and, you know, call it a day. But I don't think the Blackhawks are going to do it like that. I think they are working on a negotiation and trying to make this partnership work, because Strome is a big part of, you know, he gets along really well with Patrick Kane and Alex DeBrincat. Like, that trio talks, lives, and breathes hockey together. And if he's not in Chicago, like, that's certainly going to ruffle some feathers even more in the organization as far as the players, because Strome and DeBrincat obviously had that ridiculous chemistry in the OHL, and then Strome gets traded to Chicago, and he develops this really good chemistry with Patrick Kane. And so I expect that deal to be done by the end of the season, or by the start of the season. I just don't know when it's going to happen, but I would say definitely before training camp.
Charlie Remouliotis covers the Chicago Blackhawks for NBC Sports in Chicago. Charlie, appreciate your time. Appreciate your insight. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you, guys. Have a great weekend.
Likewise, Charlie. Take care. When we come back, we take a look at our Winnipeg Jets overseas reports. Some of the Jets prospects and players playing over in Europe will tell you how they've been doing over the past week or so. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast.
On TSN 1290.ca.
Puusisen, Puusinen keskusta. Vesalainen lauko! Kahteen yhteen! Vesalaisen ranne. Sitä nähtiin hänen avausottelussaan tällä kaudella IFK:ta vastaan. Ja kyllä se ranne, se on nyt todettu pariin. Christian Vesalainen.
My understanding is that Christian Vesalainen was showing some good finish with that goal.
Ooh.
And I'm gone. See you guys. Your show is on your own from now on after that.
When are we going to go to Finland, boys, and broadcast from Finland?
I'm pretty sure you're not allowed out of the country.
and you're not talking about the pandemic.
Yeah, that's in the normal course.
No, I think Interpol has a red alert out for you at all times, so nobody's letting you into their country.
Interpol, isn't that like Britain?
Well, I think it's sort of...
They're universal. They're like...
Oh, is it?
Yeah, it's like a big European policing
I'm
organization.
I'm not an espionage student like you are, Drew.
Well, you know, you can aspire to be like me if you want. Anyways, welcome back to the Illegal
Curve
Hockey Show Saturday morning. That was a goal by Christian Vesalainen, who's playing overseas in Finland. And, of course, that leads us to our Illegal Curve question of the day. We want to hear from you about this topic. Which current Winnipeg Jets prospect that's playing overseas in Europe? We're looking at forwards only. Which forward do you think has the best chance of being a regular for the 2021 season? Tweet at us at Illegal Curve. Text us 129090. Which current Winnipeg Jets prospect playing overseas, which forward has a chance of being a regular for the upcoming season?
Right, and we want to hear from the listeners. Obviously, you know, the two main guys are Christian Vesalainen and David Gustafsson. I mean, Juuso Luoto has a shot, Dave, I think you'd agree, and he's putting up some nice numbers early in the season, but, I mean, he's a guy that, you know, is more of a long shot to play for the Jets. Who knows, with injuries, maybe he gets a shot, but...
Yep.
You know, David Gustafsson has really been impressive, and Dave, you can speak to it more than I can, but, you know, I'm just watching some of the highlights, and you know, this is a guy that, you know, played a little bit with the Jets, but he only scored the one goal, but you're starting to see with a little bit more ice, you know, he's putting up some nice numbers.
I think the Gustafsson, I think Vesalainen and Dave, even Luoto, to your point, Ezzy, I think these guys, when training camp starts, are going to have such an advantage over what I'll call some of the other guys who are battling for positions. You know, Christian Vesalainen and, you know, Gustafsson playing against men, playing, you know, real hockey overseas for the last number of weeks, coming into Jets training camp compared to a guy like Mason Appleton, for example, a guy who's a nice prospect who had a bit of an injury-riddled year last year.
Yeah.
But boy, do I think that Gustafsson and Vesalainen are going to have a leg up on Appleton when it comes to training camp and it comes to making a good impression on the coaching staff.
Yeah, I agree with you, Drew. And I talked to CJ Cease about this after he signed his deal with the Jets, because I said, you know, that's one question I have is how do you maintain that level of readiness to get ready for a season that you don't even know when it's going to happen versus other thing, you know, guys who are playing. And he said it's a difficult proposition because you're training, but it's very hard because these guys are so structured in their usual training regimens. And I talked to Pascal Vincent about it, the head coach of the Manitoba Moose, in the summer. And I said, and he goes, we're going to see who's really taken their fitness and their focus properly and who's really been ready because of guys who are going to be ready for it. So I agree with you, Drew. I think the guys like Gustafsson and Vesalainen and Luoto, they're all going to have a leg up because they've been playing hockey regularly for some time now. And they're scoring and they're producing. And their level of fitness will be at a pro level already versus guys who are going to have to ramp it up. Some guys haven't played since March of last year.
It's a tremendous time off the ice, which we all know. But, you know, Gustafsson and even more so than Gustafsson, even Vesalainen, the fact that they're playing overseas and producing, to your point.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Gustafsson's a point-a-game player right now overseas in Sweden. He's at 15 points in 15 games. And whatever you want to say about, you know, the quality of the competition, it's pretty good hockey.
The Finnish league and Swedish league are really good leagues.
Yeah, they're not playing against scrubs.
No, these are you know, the third and fourth best leagues in the entire world, right? The Continental Hockey League, I think you guys would agree, is probably the second best. But we're talking about top leagues here.
In terms of, including the NHL.
Gustafsson is in the second tier of the Swedish league.
Right, right?
But it's still a good league.
But even the second tier Swedish league is very good, right?
Of course.
So, like, Vesalainen, I think, has the upper hand just because of his age and obviously where he was drafted. But, you know, Gustafsson, guys, I mean, we talked about this. 2018 was the year that the Jets didn't have the first round pick. So Gustafsson right now is looking at a steal. Like, this is a guy that probably, I think, Dave, you'd agree, he projects more as a middle six center, right? Like second or third line, probably more like third line, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So nobody's saying that he's going to be the Jets' second line center in 2 years. But you look at Gustafsson, and he has a really good shot possibly to play on the Jets' fourth line. Now, where does that leave Nate Thompson?
Well, if Nate Thompson has to be in the press box for the entirety of the year, that's not a big problem.
Right, and you know, a lot of people have Nate Thompson penciled in as the Jets' fourth line center. I'm just saying, we're not sure, you know, whether the Jets, you know, would prefer David Gustafsson stays in Sweden or if they're going to give him a shot. I think there's no doubt he is going to be given a shot, right? I don't think they're going to bring him over here necessarily,
you know, with the quarantining and everything like that, if they're not going to give him a real shot.
That's a fair point.
And Vesalainen, guys, is somebody to really watch because, you know, Dave has been saying this for so long. You know, there's a strong argument to be made that, you know, maybe Adam Lowry's line should be a fourth line, right? Like maybe you have, you know, Mason Appleton, Adam Lowry, Andrew Kopp, for example, is your fourth line. Mm-hmm. But you probably want Kopp on your third line. But the point is, a guy like Christian Vesalainen, you forget, he had to wait to sign with a team, right? Like we were wondering, you know, a couple of months ago, like why isn't Vesalainen signed with a team yet? And then he goes back to Finland and plays for HBK. I'm not going to pronounce the rest of it there, Dave. But, you know, Vesalainen is a guy that, you know, I think has been forgotten.
Uh-huh.
And he has a shot, really, to make the Jets, not 2 years from now, but this year, because of that offensive element he adds.
Yeah.
And again, we're not sure if he's going to be able to translate what he's doing in Finland to the Jets, but he's definitely a guy to keep your eye on.
Again, more than a point a game playing overseas in Finland, if I'm not mistaken, 4 goals, 4 assists, 8 points in 7 games, if the numbers are up to date. And Dave,
no, they're not. He's got, I think he's up to 5 goals now.
Okay, well, there you go. And Dave does a great job on illegalcurve.com. I'm a company man of keeping that up to date. But, you know, for a guy like Vesalainen, who's playing overseas, and he's probably, you'd have to assume he's playing with a decent amount of confidence, given that he's producing, to come back into training camp and being able to hit the ground running, you know, I think that's going to be a huge advantage. And he's a bit of a forgotten prospect right now in that he's not, you know, he's not at the forefront of everyone's mind. He's not Cole Perfetti, of course, and he's not Gustafsson. He's almost even, you know, just a bit forgotten, and I think it's going to be a huge advantage for him when he comes to Jets training camp, when training camp begins.
There's no question about it, and it's interesting because I tweeted out a video of him scoring the other day. He's 4-4, by the way. He's got 4 goals, 4 assists.
That's what I said.
But the point is that, and it's funny because somebody tweeted back to me, said, he's a bust, let's move on. I said, the guy's 21 years old. He has plenty of road left ahead of him. I mean, it's a little bit, I've never understood the idea of labeling guys who don't have immediate, again, we've talked about this on the show so many times. Not everybody's going to be a Patrick Laine. But Christian Vesalainen has a heck of a shot. He's got a lot of talent. Does he have elements of his game that need to be worked on? Absolutely. But could I see him, if you put him in a top 9 scoring role with the Winnipeg Jets, having success? Absolutely could.
When we come back, we're going to be joined by Joe Haggerty. He's with Boston Hockey Now. We'll talk about the Bruins and their offseason. Much more to come. We want to hear from you, of course, throughout the program at Illegal Curve. Send us some text messages to 129090. Whatever you want is on your mind, let us know. You're listening to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
The podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.